Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Tuesday, the 11th of November, welcome, 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 friends, to the program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt.
It is Veterans Day, and I want to start by thanking all of our veterans and military families for their sacrifice and service to our country. 200,000 military service members transition from service every single year. Roughly half of all veterans say that adjusting to civilian life was harder than they expected. 1 in 10 experience housing insecurity, and veterans face higher unemployment in their first year out. So today on the show, we're going to talk about life after service. And I have to say, for me, it's personal. Many of you know my husband is a 26-year Marine Corps veteran, highly decorated person from the Marine Corps. And I met him just a few months after he got out of the Marine Corps. So I watched him up close go through that rough time of transitioning into civilian life. And almost 5 years later, he's doing great, but he is really lucky. And so today we're going to hear from two veterans who actually work with veterans. And we want to hear from you, especially veterans and their families. What was the transition to civilian life like for you, and what did you find most challenging? You can call us. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, leave your comments in the chat. And of course, we welcome memories. Doesn't matter the war that your veteran family member may have participated in. We'd love to hear your story.
Absolutely. 888-477-9499. Again, the email is studio2@whyy.org. But first, before we get to all of that, a trio of local news stories, Cherry, and we'll start in Harrisburg.
Yep.
Don't we love to start in Harrisburg?
We love Harrisburg.
Shout out Harrisburg. All right. As the federal government shutdown nears its end, it looks like Pennsylvania's four-month budget stalemate may also be on the verge of a breakthrough compromise.
Oh.
And just like in D.C., the compromise floating around Harrisburg right now has drawn some pretty big pushback. Stephen Caruso from Spotlight PA reports that Governor Josh Shapiro and other leading Democrats are considering a budget deal that would require Pennsylvania to pull out of an environmental pact called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or REGI. REGI, if you don't know, is a cooperative agreement with other nearby states that charges power plants for the carbon they emit. Pennsylvania kind of joined REGI in 2019 via executive action, but full joining of REGI has been halted by various legal challenges which are ongoing. Many members of the GOP do not like REGI. They believe it will hurt the state's large energy industry. And interestingly here, especially for this negotiation, Josh Shapiro himself never been a huge fan of REGI and has proposed his own alternate Pennsylvania-specific plan to cap carbon emissions. But the long story short is this. It seems a compromise on climate policy could be a key, or the key, to ending PA's budget impasse.
Fingers crossed, right? And REGI had been rumored to have been a bargaining chip in budget negotiations from past years, so it's not a surprise that it's coming up again. But this budget impasse has been brutal, okay? Because I want to remind everybody that this budget was due June 30th, and we are more than 4 months behind schedule. The state literally owes billions of dollars in payments. We have counties, school districts, other organizations that are depending on these dollars. They're going into debt to remain in operation. At least one school district has said it will be forced to close if no deal is reached by June 30th. So the pressure is mounting. It's getting really real, and a deal needs to happen, and everybody's sort of feeling it. And we remember when SEPTA was sort of the bargaining chip. And then they came up with this workaround for SEPTA, but now the pressure is mounting again.
Also brutal, climate change,
yes,
by the way.
So the way.
Let's not pass right over that. Mm-mm. But look, Pennsylvania is an outlier state in this region because it is a huge energy producer.
Yep,
it's sort of like the Texas of its region, right? And so there was always a little misalignment between Pennsylvania and some of the other states. Of course, It still matters.
How are you going to deal with this?
The issue still matters. Carbon emissions still matter just because Pennsylvania produces a lot of energy. So there's going to be a ton of pushback here, I expect.
Yes. Second story. Pennsylvania Senator John Fetterman's memoir, Unfettered, was released today. And in it, apparently, he reveals that in hindsight, I should have quit. And this is when he refers to his race for U.S. Senate. Now, if you recall, Fetterman had a life-threatening stroke just 4 days before the Democratic primary back in 2022. Now, the details of this intimate revelation, they were detailed in an excerpt that was released in the Free Press this week. And in the memoir, I mean, Fetterman goes into detail about the stroke and the depression that followed. His wife, Giselle, was with him on May 13, 2022, when they were headed to a campaign event. And that's when she noticed that his mouth was drooping. And luckily, they were just 10 minutes away from a hospital in Lancaster that specializes in strokes. And he actually said in the memoir that he would have died had this not been the case. So he was really lucky. But he goes on to talk about after the stroke, he couldn't hear and could only communicate for quite some time using a whiteboard, and that he told himself that he would drop out of the race if his symptoms did not improve by August 15th of that year. Luckily, things did get better and he forged on. But he said in hindsight, he should have probably quit. I mean, he was living in his parents' basement at one point because the depression had gotten so bad that his wife didn't feel like it was good for him to be home with the kids and everything. And so this was a really rough time. And also in the memoir, he talks about, you know, his belief system. A lot of Democrats who voted for him feel like he's fallen out of line with the party. And so he actually reveals some of that. And I'll read a quote. He says, "I've never viewed my political party as an iron shackle adhering me to the party line. And I don't take positions for my own self-interest." He says, "I take positions based on what I believe is right."
From the reviews that I had read, however, it sounded like, I haven't read the book yet. Obviously, yeah. It just came out. But it sounded like there was a lot less about his politics than a typical political memoir. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're looking for a full-throated defense or explanation for why he has diverged from the party on some really, really key issues, like, my sense from what I've read about the book is that it's really not in there. It's, you know, most political memoirs are like, this is my life, and this is why I believe what I believe, and here's my political manifesto. My sense is that if that's what you're looking for, this memoir really isn't that, as much as it is about his battle with depression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which, you know, he's talked about openly. And that was the big part of the excerpt that was released. Yeah. So that book drops today if people are interested or not.
Now let's go back to Harrisburg. Why not? Mm-hmm. It's like we never left.
No. Did a little windy right back.
Yeah, right back. Yeah, we really never left central Pennsylvania, really. A Pennsylvania lawmaker has reintroduced legislation to legalize and regulate flying cars.
Whoosh.
In Pennsylvania. Democrat Marty Flynn is behind the bill. It is literally called, I'm not making this up, the Jetsons Act. It would allow rotable aircraft, that's what they're called, to be operated in PA under a pretty basic regulatory framework that mirrors what cars are regulated under. This seems somewhat symbolic because there are major federal restrictions on how these aircraft are used. But if you haven't heard a lot about this issue, there have been some really interesting and maybe consequential breakthroughs in the flying car space over the last year or two, including this company Pivotal, which makes an electric flying car that can be operated, they say, with just a couple weeks training. You don't need like a pilot's license. So this space is really bubbling right now, even if this law doesn't mean you're going to see like flying cars zipping all over Pennsylvania anytime soon.
So I'm really glad that we won't be seeing that. You know, these experimental aircraft.
You're not ready for the revolution.
Over major cities. I'm not ready for the revolution yet. But, you know, especially with humans in them, right? But it is really cool. And apparently, like you said, these vehicles are easy to fly. They had this Pivotal backfly. That's one example. And apparently they use a joystick.
Yeah, it's just a joystick.
And teenagers, it's so easy to fly that a teenager can fly it.
That's
right?
What we want. Teenagers flying cars. That's what we want.
And they, you know, but I do think states need to get on this because, you know, you have a lot of companies that are using drone technology to make deliveries and
Sure. They're
whipping around, they're delivering food to you.
Sounds chaotic.
You know, Wendy's can deliver, you know, the little burgers
Wendy's?
To you. Apparently Wendy's
Dang.
Can deliver
Love
using
those square
drones.
Burgers.
And so, you know, we got to get on top of this before it gets away from us.
My big question with flying cars is why? Mm-hmm. Why?
Why not?
But why? But do we need, like, I guess I've always wondered, are we developing flying cars because they solve a transportation need or just because every movie we saw about the future had flying cars? Therefore, let's do it.
Yes and yes. I mean, because think about it. If you had a flying car, you could zip right over the traffic jam on the Schuylkill.
Not if everyone else has a flying car, then we're just sitting in traffic again. I don't know.
Anyway, it's veterans.
Email your thoughts to studio2@whyy.org. Flying cars. Yay or nay.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Erik.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. There are roughly 16 million veterans in the U.S., and each of them has gone through some version of the same transition, from in the service to out. It's a transition filled with opportunity and fraught with tension.
And each generation of soldiers faces its own transition challenges. The vets of today live in an America where fewer and fewer people can relate to their specific experiences. Just 6% of American adults served in the armed forces in 1980. That number was 18%.
And today we'll focus on what it's like to become a civilian again. We'll look at the triumphs, the setbacks, and what society could do better to help veterans. Our guests today are Patrick Murphy, former Undersecretary of the Army and Executive Director of Hilco Global's Geopolitical Unit. Patrick, welcome to Studio 2.
Cherry, Avi, thank you so much. It's great to be on with Kat. Happy Veterans Day, everybody. And Cherry, I'm sorry your husband couldn't get in America's varsity team, our Army, but the Marine Corps is a great team. So
yeah, we'll get into that.
I can say that in full confidence, being on Zoom, and he's not right there to disagree with me.
For sure. In studio, we have Kat Kirkman, an Air Force veteran and social worker with Veterans Multi-Service Center. Kat, welcome to Studio 2, and happy Veterans Day to you as well.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And you want to pitch the Air Force real quick as the number one branch?
Kat is actually incorrect. And uh-huh. Air Force is the varsity. We're at 30,000 feet. Thank you.
All right.
Kat and Pat, love the energy
love
so far.
It.
So as always, the phone lines and inboxes are open. We want to hear from veterans and their family members. What was the transition to civilian life like? What did you find most challenging or most rewarding? Give us a call. 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. YouTube, Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
And so we wanted to start with both of you, just sort of your service story. And so, Kat, we're going to start with you. I know you're fourth generation military. And so tell us what made you decide, you know what, I'm going to go into the family business, so to speak, and I'm going to join the Air Force. Tell us about your journey.
Well, I mean, both my parents actually served in the Navy. And so I grew up on Navy bases that turned into joint Air Force Navy bases. And so I was surrounded by it. I mean, like you mentioned, like the percentage of people who are related to somebody who served or who have served themselves is smaller. But for me, I was surrounded by it my entire life. And so, I mean, I even did junior ROTC in high school. That's actually where I met my husband, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. And I knew I wanted to be a pilot. I had aspirations to become an astronaut. And I wasn't crazy enough to land on a moving runway like my Navy brethren. So I wanted to join the Air Force and thought, you know, the best Air Force officers must go to the Air Force Academy. And so that's where I set my sights. And that's what I ended up doing. And really, really enjoyed my time in the Air Force.
Yeah. And then you transitioned out.
Yes.
What was that like?
So they, everybody like warned you that it's tough, that it's a hard thing to do, but it was so much more difficult than I expected. I ended up being medically retired. And so for me, it was definitely not part of the plan. Mm-hmm. And I'm very much a planner. And so my 20-year plan had turned into, oh, by the way, this is happening now. And so
just so for folks who don't understand, you have just no control over that.
Right. And okay. So like I had tried to see if I could change jobs, but the physical requirements are very strict for pilots. And so and it just sometimes with the military, especially the circumstance of timing and what's going on with budgeting and things of that nature. And so it just didn't work out for me to be able to like transition to a different job within the Air Force. And so it was kind of quickly that it was all of a sudden, all right, you know, you've got 3 months and you're going to be out. And so after 10 years of being in the Air Force and wearing the uniform every day and thinking this is what I was doing with my life, like I truly feel like I was put on this planet to be an Air Force officer. Mm-hmm. And then to be told basically the Air Force said, you know, it's not us, it's you, and have a bad breakup. And so it was really, really challenging with that piece. And a part of me had to kind of grieve that as well.
Yeah, that life. Patrick, we want to bring you into the conversation. Tell me what attracted you to the Army. Tell us a little bit about your journey through the military.
Yeah, Terry, for me, you know, I come from a family of public servants, you know, whether it's to our church or to our community. I'm a third generation veteran. My grandfather served in World War II with the Navy. My two uncles served in Vietnam. My dad served in the Navy during the Vietnam era. And then my brother, JJ Murphy, he served two deployments after 9/11 with the Air Force. And obviously I served in the Army. So for me, I joined at 19. I grew up in a row house in Northeast Philadelphia. In fact, everyone in our neighborhood either was like a cop, a firefighter, a postal worker. So Terry, honestly, and Avi, like if you didn't wear a uniform, I thought you were unemployed, right? Yeah. That's kind of how, you know, we grew up with that row house mentality. You care about the people on your left and your right. But for me, the Army was incredible. I mean, I went from full-time community college at age 17 to joining Army ROTC, earning my commission as an Army officer. And then the Army cut me loose to go to law school. I went back into the Army as a judge advocate, as a lawyer. And it opened up so many doors. I mean, after being a prosecutor, they asked me to join the faculty at West Point. So, you know, being age 27, teaching constitutional and military law to the next generation of veterans was just an awesome responsibility. But unfortunately, I was there when 9/11 happened. And, you know, I'd already been airborne in air assault school. That's where you jump out of airplanes or rappel out of helicopters. And I volunteered for combat deployments, and I went first with the 25th Infantry Division, and then was in Evasion Iraq with the 82nd Airborne Division as a paratrooper. And I, unfortunately, I lost 19 men in my unit, and came back. And like most veterans, I was independent. I wasn't affiliated either way, but I came back and ran for the U.S. Congress and won in what's now called the Pennsylvania First District, which was Northeast Philadelphia, at all Bucks County, and a small slice of Montgomery County is America's first Iraq vet.
Wow. And so what was the transition out of the service like for you? You're in an unusual position as someone who was, you know, a little further along in your career path, maybe when you did that deployment so you would think maybe you might have a leg up, but it was still difficult from what I understand coming back home. Describe that difficulty, and also, you know, looking back, why you think there was a period of I think, and you even say it's sort of a period of floundering.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I joked that my toughest job wasn't 138 degrees in Baghdad, Iraq, and getting shot at. It was really, you know, being an Eagle security guard at the old Veterans Stadium. tougher duty. But no, listen, I want to agree with what Kat said. Transitions are hard. And yes, there's a sea of goodwill out there, but a lot of our brothers and sisters drowned in that sea of goodwill. I started as a messenger. My mother was a legal secretary. My father was a cop in Philly. So I had a little bit of connections, meaning in a law, you know, working as a messenger. But after law school and after the 5 years in the Army JAG Corps, when I came back, I knew I had to get, the right job, not just a job. And so, I was unemployed, Avi, for 4 months. I talked about it in my recent Substack, column. And, I talk about how I would still wear a blazer and a shirt every day, acting like I was, interviewing and applying, et cetera. But to me, I knew I had to go not just to a law firm, but to the right one that fit, what I want to do, which was eventually I knew it was going to be political public service. And I eventually got there. But, when you have 200,000 folks that are active service in the military and military spouses, when they transition every year, there is a lot that fall through the cracks. And that's what Kat does every day. And I try to do that as well.
Yeah, I want to read this comment from Adomi R on YouTube, who says, "When I got out, I was excited that employers would value my experience, especially from companies that are, quote, veteran friendly, end quote. What that really meant was hiring me was just a check in the box." And so I want to sort of bring you back into the conversation, Kat, because I don't think a lot of people who've never been in the military really understand what it feels like to be in, right? Mm-hmm. And the services that you get, like living on base and all this life that you live, and then what it's like to go from that to being in civilian life.
Right.
So could you just try to explain that difference and why that transition is so rough for a lot of people?
Well, it's a few different things. One of the things that people maybe don't think of is choice. Mm. You're actually overwhelmed by choice. And so at least I was. And so you go from, you wearing a uniform every day. You're told exactly which uniform to wear every day. You're told to be here at this time, be there at that time. The career path for a lot of folks in the military is pretty linear, and you know what boxes you need to check, what you need to accomplish. And so it's very, very structured. And even, where you live, what bases you go to, even your job isn't necessarily, you may not have a whole lot of input. And so you go from that to getting out where you have to decide everything for yourself. And it can be really overwhelming, especially because so many folks go in at 17, 18, 19, and like myself. And so you grew up in the military and you learned how to be an adult, or how what you thought being an adult was in the military. And you find out it's much different. Mm. There's a lot more choice and decisions that you need to make and figure out. But the thing that I would say is the most challenging and kind of heartbreaking is the loss of community and identity. And so you go from being surrounded by folks that kind of understand you, who have been through similar things with you, whether that's different types of trainings or deployments or whatever the case may be. And so they get it. And you just have like a really special bond. And a lot of people have a hard time making civilian friends while they're in the military, unless maybe you have like a civilian spouse that might help with that some. But you end up not only just working with these folks all day, every day, you spend most of your time with them outside of office hours. Mm-hmm. And so, you might be flying. Like for me, I spent my deployments, we had 90-hour work weeks that we spent with the same four people.
Right. That's a tight bond.
That's like family at that point. Yeah.
And no matter, how many times you move and everything, when you get to a new place, even if the folks are all new to you, they all still have those similar experiences. They've all gone through that struggle of coming to this new place.
Yeah.
And people are very open and welcoming to help one another. And so, and you have all the resources of the base as well. If you need anything, you know where to go, or, you go to your chain of command. They tell you.
It's going from very anchored to a little unmoored, sounds like. And, it's funny, you almost anticipated what Rob's comment was. Rob says, mm-hmm. I didn't serve, but one question I have for vets is, how much the decision fatigue of daily life figures into the adjustment process. And that's exactly what you were talking about. Mike from Germantown has served in the Army for 6 years and says, do not underestimate the opportunity the Army gives you to grow and develop as a person. There is no civilian equivalent, especially for young people. Yeah. So we don't want to have this whole conversation, right, Pat, just from a deficit mindset. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of skills you get. So I'm curious how you were able to tap into those, to realize those were strengths, and to use those in your transition, looking back now. Like, are there things that are like, yeah, I got that in the military, and it gave me a leg up when I was trying to establish my career?
Yeah, there's no doubt our veterans are civic assets to this nation. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't have been where I was or where I am now if it wasn't for the Army. And I've transitioned out of government three times. One as an Army captain with the 82nd Airborne Division back in 2004. I transitioned out of Congress back in 2011. And I transitioned out of Pentagon with the Trump administration back in 2017. But the crux of his comment was that, you know, people think that being a veteran is like some type of like last resort thing. Literally, it is not. I mean, I went to summer school twice in high school. I was at Archbishop Ryan High School in the Northeast. I was always a hard worker. I didn't work smart. The Army gave me that discipline. And to Kat's point, you're disciplined in that. You don't get necessarily a choice, right? You're doing this stuff. And then when you leave, you know, I still find discipline in that. Like, I work out every morning and I set my clothes out the night before because I don't want to wake up and be like, well, when am I going to go to the gym today? It won't happen, right? I got to just knock it out.
Oh, yeah.
And discipline is more important than motivation, because you don't have motivation at 0:30 in the morning when, you know, you watch the Eagles game last night, you know, beating the Green Bay Packers, right? So, you know, I do think that most folks don't understand that veterans, and I've been able to focus on entrepreneurship. You know, I teach part-time at Wharton Business School. About 8% of our incoming MBA students are veterans. I'm a venture capitalist where I invest in veteran companies. But Avi, to your point, we need to give opportunities for veterans to start their own small business. Half the veterans in World War II created these iconic global brands, companies like Comcast. Ralph Roberts was a Navy veteran.
Yeah.
Walmart, Sam Walton, Army veteran. Nike, Phil Knight and Bill Bowerman start Nike, two Army veterans, right? So I say those things because my generation, Kat's and I generation, is less than 5% that start their own small business. So access to capital is a big deal, mentorship. So that's what I do at Wharton and as a venture capitalist. But to me, it's those opportunities. And one last thing I'll say is, when I say they're civic assets, yes, veterans are more likely to vote in elections, even though 53% of veterans are independents. Veterans are more likely to be Little League coaches and pastors in their churches. And they're more likely to start these small businesses and for those small businesses to be successful, because they know what it takes to win. They will work their towels off to win, to accomplish a mission.
Mm. I love that. I love that. By the way, we want to hear from you, our listeners at home, on the road and elsewhere. And we particularly want to hear from veterans and their families. What was the tradition? What was the transition to civilian life like for you and your family? And what did you find most challenging or rewarding? You can call 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, drop your comment in the chat. And I noticed one thing that stood out to me was a lot of veterans have all this experience in the military. I mean, amazing experience. And you would want this person on your team. But a hard thing, a hard transition point, Kat, is translating some of the things, your problem-solving abilities, all the things you learn how to do during combat, during your military service, into a civilian job. And because you read some of these resumes and you're like, I don't know what that means. Yep. If you're a civilian, can you explain how, you know, folks work with veterans to sort of help them say it in English so civilians can see the value that they bring right on the page?
I mean, you hit the nail on the head. It's one, veterans understanding that there is value there, and then how to use that to connect with employers. I will say, so I run an employment and training program for the Veterans Multi-Service Center, and part of what our program does is work directly with employers to tell them about the benefits of hiring veterans and what kind of skills veterans have that can bring to the table that you don't necessarily find in the civilian workforce. And so things like you mentioned, as well as that hard work, that determination, flexibility and adaptability. I love hiring veterans for my team as well. I'm fortunate about half of my team are veterans. And it's just a different kind of mentality. A lot of things kind of roll off our backs a little bit easier than our civilian counterparts. But there's some really great resources out there these days, you know, thankfully with the internet now, things like ONET that can translate some of these military jobs and descriptions into civilian speak. And programs like ours and 4Block and IVMF who can help veterans with translating that. Because it's one thing to say, oh, you just, you know, use this link or whatever and translate it into English, basically. But if you don't know what the English version is, it's not necessarily helpful. And so teaching people, you know, okay, you were a sergeant in the Army. All right, what does that look like? Okay, you know, you're a mid-level supervisor. And they're like, I was?
News to me. Yes. I want to read this comment from Linda in Rising Sun, Maryland, who says, I work with and hire a lot of veterans. I love it. They are very disciplined and structured. I was thinking about this conversation, Kat, and I was thinking about, like, what are, like, the pop culture depictions of veteran transition that immediately pop up in my mind. Yeah. The first one for me was Lieutenant Dan from Forrest Gump. And spoiler alert for a 35-year-old movie, but doesn't go great for Lieutenant Dan as he leaves Vietnam. So, and that's, I think, a kind of a trope, the sort of the lost, the wayward veteran suffering from a lot of post-traumatic stress to the point where it consumes them. And I'm curious what you, as a veteran, think about those depictions. Is it sort of over-sensationalized? Is it, you know, depicting something important that we need to focus on? You know, just your sense of how the media and how people view veterans coming back home.
So that's such a great question because I'm torn. It depends on how well it's presented, but there is definitely an overemphasis on things like PTSD and that all veterans are broken. And that's just not the case. Most veterans are out here thriving. And are doing really well and doing amazing things, whether that's, you know, in Congress or running their own businesses and or working at places like the VMC and other nonprofits helping others, because a lot of veterans are very service driven and need that sense of purpose. I know that was very important for me. And so this idea that we're all violent or broken or we've all seen combat is definitely a misconception, but there are plenty of us that are, you know, struggling with those things. Myself, I struggle with anxiety and depression, and, you know, during my transition, it, like, depression was definitely a facet of that, but it doesn't mean we're not capable of doing amazing things as well. And so I just don't want people to think of that's all we are. And I will say, having lived in 15 states across the U.S., I've seen a lot of different communities and how folks kind of view veterans. And unfortunately, I feel like Philadelphia is not the most veteran-friendly city.
Oh, interesting.
Interesting, yeah.
And so there are those of us here and veterans here in the city who are really trying to change that and really trying to show folks how useful and important and the quality of people that veterans are. For instance, one of the things that we run into trouble with sometimes at VMC is we have a very large housing program and we work directly with landlords to house our veterans. And some landlords do not want to house our veterans because they have these misconceptions.
They have a dim view of veterans. Yes. I think they'll be erratic.
That they have PTSD and they've seen these versions of PTSD in the media, or that they're violent or they all have guns and just, you know, jump to conclusions that aren't necessarily true, you know. Now, don't get me wrong, we're not perfect. Too many people do put veterans on a pedestal. In the end, we're just people. And so we have the same problems as everybody else.
Well, you go ahead, Pat.
Can I just real quick, because
Yeah.
Kat's point is really important, because when you turn on TV, you see, oh, for only $19 a month, you can help these poor veterans. The perception out there is that we are, we've lost our limbs, that, we're struggling, that, we're deformed. And that's not the reality. There are our brothers and sisters that has happened to, and we got to take care of them. We have
Yeah.
an ethic that we leave no one behind. But that is not that the reality of the situation. We are civic assets. And the Kat's point, and that's why what she does at the VMC, the Veterans Multi-Service Center, is so incredibly important. I literally last night was watching Eagles game. I got an email, I'm sorry, a text from a formerly homeless veteran, Afghan war veteran, named Nick. I won't give his last name. And he's waiting for his housing voucher, but we got him an apartment in Marshfield, Bucks County. And there was an issue, and I literally got his information, sent his cell phone to Joe Brooks, Kat's boss, and said, "Hey Joe, would you mind, sorry for emailing, at 9:30 at night, but is there any way you could have one of your teammates here, take care of Nick? There's an issue with his, housing voucher, and he's worried about getting evicted." Now, I'm not trying to blame his, landlord. I don't know who that person is, but I will say there are a lot of folks out there that give lip service, like, "Hey, I love the military, I love veterans, but it's not for my son and daughter, it's not for my niece and nephew." And that gets irritating, when I see it with my own eyes, because, you can't say one thing and do another. These are great civic assets, great young Americans that are just trying to give back and live a purpose-driven life.
We're gonna keep talking about all that on the other side of this break, and maybe get into a little bit of like what services and benefits are available to veterans and what's not. Keep those comments coming. Studio2@whyy.org. The number's 888-477-9499. We'll be right back on Studio 2.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Today on Veterans Day, we're talking about the challenges service members face returning to the civilian world and what it takes to make a new life after a military career. With us this hour are two veterans. We have Kat Kirkman, an Air Force veteran and social worker with Veterans Multi-Service Center. And also joining us is Patrick Murphy, former Undersecretary of the Army and the Executive Director of Hilco Global's Geopolitical Unit.
And we'd love to hear from our veterans out there, family members of veterans. What was the transition to civilian life like for you? What did you find most challenging or rewarding? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
And I want to bring in a caller. We have Pat from Bryn Mawr on the line. Pat, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
I just want to say I'm really glad to hear you guys talk about this, because I've been an executive recruiter for 25-plus years and have done a lot of hiring out of the military. And some of the best candidates I've ever seen have come from the military. It's one of these things where it depends often on the job that they're coming to and that they came out of. So, for example, if you have somebody in the military that's been running around the world for 20 years, them studying why the peanut butter is slow for Walmart's logistics does not work out too well.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times, because everything's open to them and people know they're disciplined and people know you can trust them to do your best, like they try to fit square pegs into the round hole. So I often tell military people they need to stop thinking of the world as an oyster and narrow down. Narrow down at what you want.
Yeah.
And you'll find the fit. And I'd rather take a military veteran than a college graduate any day of the week.
Mm. All right. Pat from Bryn Mawr.
Thank you so much for that call. Interesting perspective from someone in the hiring world.
Yeah, I love that. And Patrick, I wanted to sort of follow up with you, because you talked about that after World War II, veterans came home and built the middle class. Mm-hmm. And, today, less than 1 in 5 lawmakers and fewer than 5% of Iraq and Afghanistan vets start their own businesses. I want to just ask you, what do you think changed and what's different about the America that our veterans are coming home to today that has made things so different?
Yeah, well, you got to remember, today there's like 36 million small businesses, right? And It is, we're double the size as far as population in America than it was back in, 1944, 1946, et cetera, after World War II. But a lot of those folks came back and they started doing small business, or they, joined a small business. A lot of our generation, Katz and I generation, have gone back and, went to corporate America or other small businesses. And that's fine. But, the obvious earlier question I would say, Jerry, is like, what movie, what movie, it's like Office Space, right? Because you go back and you serve, you go to PT in the morning, you're doing a job, whether you're like Kat, like a pilot, or me, a lawyer, or a mechanic, whatever. But you go into the civilian sector and it's like TPS reports and red staplers.
It's
And like,
boring.
right? And it's like, and for veterans who live this purpose-driven life, they have to find another purpose, and they might not get it from their 9 to 5. They might get it on the side by being a little league coach, or joining their American Legion, or frankly, just doing something else, on the side with their life and trying to find a new tribe. So I think that's part of this. When you come back home, like I knew I was coming back home to Philadelphia. 85% of the veterans, though, that transition out of the military don't go back to the home of record, don't go back to their area. So like, for me, because I have cousins in South Philly and Fairmount and East Falls and Northeast Philly. Like, I knew I was coming back home. I didn't have a job lined up, but to me, to have that basically that family, because I was gone for so long, that I could go back and bounce things off of was important.
So you had an anchor. You had an anchor when you got back here, a family, a community. So that wasn't a big part of the transition for you.
And even though I was like a lawyer, right? I mean, I had no lawyers in the family. So to me, but it was like, I knew what it. To me, I was unemployed for 4 months. I didn't collect unemployment because I felt like the country gave me so much at that point. Like, I earned my college degree on an Army scholarship and law school and teaching at West Point and 2 combat deployments. But for me, it was like, what's my next chapter? What am I going to do? And I still wanted to make a difference, which is why I went into political public service.
On that point, I wanted to ask you, Kat, like, I guess those of us who've never been in the military have this, very rudimentary sense of what benefits are available to veterans. Like, we think, oh, you get health care, education covered, some other ancillary benefits. And I guess it's maybe true for some people, but not all people. I know this is like a big landscape here, but if you could essentialize, like, what does the median veteran get from the government after they leave the service?
Right. So this is definitely an area where there's a lot of misinformation,
Oh, interesting. Okay.
and which causes a lot of problems and hardships for folks, because some people think, oh, I've got the golden ticket, like I'm taken care of forever. And that's just not the case. And so even with VA healthcare, for example, some people, a lot of vets will think, oh, well, I'm a vet, I get to go to the VA. And that's not true. And so there are eligibility requirements. Some of them are pretty technical about like years in service. If you served before 1980, there's different restrictions versus if you served after 1980, you had to have served for 2 years consecutively. And there's also the issue of you have a status that you get when when you leave the military. So most people have heard of the honorable discharge. And a lot of civilians know honorable and dishonorable and think that those are the only two options. But there's actually several in between that are in this middle kind of gray zone. And so I work with a lot of veterans who have other than honorable discharge status.
And what does
How do
that
you end
mean?
up in that gray zone? Yeah.
So there's a lot of issues with this because it can be completely dependent on your commander, who decides that. Sometimes there's due process, sometimes there's not. And so sometimes a vet may have gotten in trouble. And so maybe they're like, hey, you're gonna be court-martialed, or you might have to get in trouble in some capacity, or you can leave now and we're gonna give you this other than their honorable. And the veteran may not totally understand at the time how impactful that is, because as soon as they get that other than honorable, they lose their healthcare benefits, they lose their educational benefits related to the
Wow.
VA.
Wow.
And so, and don't get
All
me
because of like one person's decision in the service, like one superior's decision, essentially.
Right. And it can be from or for a wide slew of different things. So
Yeah.
everything from You know, especially in the 80s and 90s, the Navy in particular had very strict zero tolerance policy. So if you tested positive for cannabis one time, that could be enough to get you kicked out and with an other than honorable discharge. Obviously, things are quite a bit different, and our worldview on cannabis has changed significantly. Mm-hmm. Although it's still illegal for our military members, it's not as strict. And we've learned a lot in, you know, with drug policy that zero tolerance is just isn't effective anyway. But it could be, you know, I've seen even disrespectful to an officer, and there's not really any more details to that. And unfortunately, it's really impacted mostly African-American men who served like in the 80s and 90s in particular, who...
And so they just get nothing, I mean, or a little bit? Or
so they may still be able to access like some of the programs that we have at VMC. So they would still qualify for our employment and training program. They would still qualify for our housing program. There's been changes to eligibility because there's a realization that there are other reasons why someone might have another honorable. For instance, maybe they do have PTSD and, you know, went AWOL, or, you know, were self-medicating with some kind of medication and didn't get the services that they needed for their mental health. We've also learned that there's a lot of issues related to traumatic brain injuries and military sexual trauma that could impact these so different evolving. Status.
Yeah.
So some of the eligibility has changed. So fortunately, because that, and there's such a huge push and realizing that there are too many veterans who are homeless and without housing, without stable long-term housing, that now those folks are eligible for our program. So any veteran who has any discharge status, as long as it's not dishonorable, still qualifies for our housing program, our employment program, our suicide prevention program, our substance abuse program. We have legal services at VMC as well as a women's center. So they're... these types of programs are still available to them, thankfully.
Yeah, I want to bring it.
Avi and Cherry, can I just
go ahead?
I'm sorry for that.
Go ahead, please. Yes.
But to Kat's point, like, because we have this ethic, leave no one behind, and there are too many veterans. If you're broken, we got to take care of you mentally, physically, and there's benefits, and it does, you know, obviously, what your discharge, honorable, general, other than honorable or dishonorable discharge, plays into that. But on the other end of the spectrum, I do think it's important to note that there are two things that are phenomenal opportunities when you serve in the military, and, you know, and serve enough years and active duty, et cetera, but it is the GI Bill and the VA home loan.
Yep.
So GI Bill, 800,000 young Americans are using the GI Bill right now. Again, that's basically free education and a stipend when you're doing it, paying books, et cetera. But the other one is home loan. And Avi and Cherry, what I think is important, I look at young men age 18 to 24, 60% of young men still live at home.
Yeah.
They can't afford rent. They can't afford to buy a home. Having a VA home loan, that means that you still got to, you know, you don't get a free home, but that means you don't have to put the 20% down. So you're getting a regular mortgage at a great rate without having to put the 20% down and not have to pay what's called PMI, PSI. That's a phenomenal opportunity because your number one wealth builder really is one, your career, and number two is your home.
Yeah, property.
So you could just leverage those two benefits. It's phenomenal. That's why I tell people, like, my daughter's 18. She's a student at Clemson University. She's doing Air Force ROTC. Whether she sticks with it or not, we'll see, right? But just the fact that she's going to PT at 5:50 in the morning, that means she's not out late at 1994. She has to show up and be disappointed, and, you know, and hopefully crush it. But I'm sorry, I just want to get
that's a great point.
That's a great point.
The home thing is so key.
There are so many wonderful benefits. By the way, I'm going to try to get a caller, and we have Bill from North Wales, Pennsylvania on the line. Bill, you're on Studio 2. We only have I know you're a veteran. I want you to get your story in. You're on Studio 2. Go right ahead.
Sure. Well, thank you very much. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Yep.
Oh, perfect. Well, one thing that I was mentioning is I was in the military in the early 80s, and I was a combat medic, and I was hospital-based, and I was highly trained by my colonel and the captains in the emergency room, and I was also a flight medic. When I got out of the military, I was doing advanced procedures in the military. When I got out, according to civilian law, I wasn't even So the transition from running a code, doing advanced cardiac life support, suturing, you know, showing up medevac and doing all of that advanced procedure to save lives and to come out and realize that I can't even.
We're having a little trouble with the line, but thank you, Bill from North Wales. And I think from our notes, from our producer's notes, what Bill is essentially saying is like, I had all these skills, but it didn't count in the civilian world, which must be so, so frustrating when you've performed at the highest levels in high stress environments.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, veterans are great hires, because we are put in really stressful positions at a young age, given a lot of responsibility. For example, at 22 years old, I was running a satellite program at the Air Force Academy. So we literally built a satellite, launched it in space, and then did space operations. And we were the only undergrad program in the country that does that, and they do it every year. Yeah. And so, that is just not something a normal 22-year-old is going to do. And then flying, you know, an $80 million aircraft and all of these things. Yeah, yeah. And so that can be frustrating if you get back and you're told, oh, okay, you can do a warehouse job.
Before we go, we only have 30 seconds, but because you're in the policy space, Pat, real quick, one policy you think that the American government could implement to make the transition easier for veterans, if there's one thing you could do?
Share the data when Captain Patrick Murphy's going back to Philadelphia. I should have a POC at the VA, whether it's my benefits or healthcare, and not just, you know, hopefully they're going to reach out or I reach out to them, right? That warm handoff, mm-hmm. and also in that nonprofit space, right? Yeah. Well, because the VMC, what Kat and her team, Joe Brook, et cetera, what they do is life-saving, and I'm just so proud of her and her team over there.
That is Patrick Murphy, former Undersecretary of the Army, and is the Executive Director of Hilco Global's Geopolitical Unit. Thank you so much for your time today, Patrick, and same to Kat Kirkman, Air Force veteran and social worker with Veterans Multi-Service Center. Appreciate the time, both of you.
Thank you so much.
And by the way, my husband Jamie was listening. He says, please let Kat and Patrick know that I really appreciate the fun back and forth jabs between the branches. So he was definitely listening to that.
I think I have to because I know him better. I'm going to side with the Marines. I'm going to have to, guys. Thanks to our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show, executive producer Kevin McCoy from WHYY in Philly. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thanks for listening.